Hi, and welcome to The Thing About Cotton, a podcast brought to you by the International Cotton Association. We're your hosts, Camille Cluzel and Imar McDonough, members of the ICA's Women in Cotton Committee. Join us as we explore the anatomy of the cotton value chain and bring awareness to the industry through highlighting leaders and their achievements. So in our last episode, we explored the role of the ICE Futures Exchange in the cotton value chain and how it can add liquidity to market and mitigate risks for industry players. Today, we sit down to tackle the role of the cotton merchant. Cotton merchants play an active role in almost every part of the industry. They buy from farmers, sometimes own jeans and warehouses, sell cotton to textile mills, handle logistics of cotton shipments all over the world, etc. But why does this industry need merchants? Why don't mills buy directly from farmers? How do merchants utilize the futures market to help customers mitigate and manage risk? We're very fortunate today to have arguably the most famous cotton trader, Joe Nicosia. Joe Nicosia found his home in the cotton industry early on in his career. After graduating from Dartmouth College in 1981, Joe started with Louis Dreyfus as a grains trader in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But only a year later, he transferred to Allenberg Cotton Company in Memphis, Tennessee. And by 1985, he was already in charge of LDC's global cotton business. He has served various roles within Allenberg and LDC between CEO and president of Allenberg to today, trading operations officer and head of the cotton platform for Louis Dreyfus, as well as executive vice president of Louis Dreyfus Company.
In addition to being the leader of the LDC team, Joe has also been a leader in the cotton industry as a whole. He is a member of the board of directors for the American Cotton Shippers Association, where he serves as the chairman of the Futures Committee. And he's the current chair of the National Cotton Council for 2024. Apart from his impressive resume spanning over 40 years, Joe has also been a great supporter of the Women in Cotton initiative. In 2019, when Women in Cotton was given its first keynote at the ICA trade event, we asked for men to stand up and become champions for change. And Joe stood up. And that was so important in a room that was filled 90% by men. And Joe is standing up again today as he is the first male champion for change voice we have on The Thing About Cotton. So Joe, welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today and answer a few questions.
Well, thanks for having me. For both of you, I've known both of you for quite a while and I look forward to spending a little bit of time with you today.
And before we get into the role of the merchant, Joe, I'm not sure if you know about that we actually planned our first keynote session strategically around you in the October trade event in 2019. We had to decide when we would have the first Women in Cotton keynote session. And the first question was, well, when is Joe speaking? Because obviously everyone's going to turn up for Joe. So it was a no-brainer that we decided to have our session after you and also knowing that you were coming to attend the session so we could get the biggest audience possible. So we strategically used your platform as well. Thank you for that.
Oh, you. Well, I guess you could have probably done the same thing with cocktails, but
I think we did that later during that trade event, actually. And look, we know that you've talked about that you spent your life surrounded by very strong women, both in your personal life and professionally. Do you want to share a little bit with the audience about what that was like for you?
Well, you know, when I grew up, many people may have heard the story. Our father abandoned us. When we were children, I had three sisters and my mom and pretty much left us with nothing, right? We had no car, no grass, you know, no money for food or other things that were there. We actually lived off of government assistance for a while. And, you know, I actually look back at that time in our life and considering that it really formed a lot of our of who we became with me and three sisters. And yes, I was fortunate enough to be around very strong women, my mother being the strongest of all. You know, you can imagine when your world is taken away from you with nothing and you have to just pick yourself up and go back to school and get a job and raise four kids. And she did that on her own. You know, I cannot imagine being a young mother, you know, young 30s with four kids at that time of what the strength that she needed to do. But yes, I've been surrounded by, you know, very successful women. You know, my one sister had multiple years of being the CEO and chairman of IBM, and was picked for multiple years most powerful businesswoman in the world. And my other sister was head of strategy, global strategy for Accenture. And my other sister was one of the seven presidents of Coca-Cola and is now CEO of a large food manufacturing company. So I always tell everyone, in fact, I am the runt of the family.
So very, very high bars set for you. High achievers, Joe.
Yes, and I'm super proud of all of them, but maybe even more proud of the people that they are. You know, they're great people, and I've been very fortunate to be around them my life.
Yeah, and I think you've also, I know I've heard you talk in the past about some of the women that you've worked with as well and the influence that they've had on you.
Right. I mean, my first real boss was a woman, right? And Linda French, who has passed away several years ago, but who I had great respect for. And the one thing that I've loved about not just the women, but other people that I've worked with and other mentors that I've had is that they've all had very different skill sets. So it's one of the great things that I've learned in my professional life is that understanding your own strengths is one of the most important things that you can do, right? And Linda was a perfect example of that to me, where she was able to extract the best out of other people and use that to her advantage to create her own sense of value to the company and how she went about her work to do that. And so, you know, and I've been around the two of you, for example, you know, and you're two successful women in cotton that around. And it's really, I think, you know, especially in the cotton business, there's so many different avenues to be successful in our business and so many different talents that are needed. And, you know, it's great to see that people employ that and can use that business. And there's no barrier. I mean, I don't see any barrier to women in our business. You know, it's, as you said, it is more highly dominated by men that are out there, but that's slowly changing, you know, somewhat thanks to you guys and the exposure to what you've presented out into the industry in general.
Yeah, it's also, you know, I think you've recognized it as well in diversity. It's you know, you bring your strengths to the table, your individual strengths and diversity in a team. And I know you've got a very diverse team within the Dreyfus Network as well. So I think it's always a strength that you play to, isn't it? Get the most diverse minds around the conversation and see what comes from it.
For sure. And I think the other thing that's helped us too is that in the cotton business in particular, I think some of the foreign countries are even more diverse, you know, where we see women in leading positions in many of these other countries around the world. So I think it's important to be able to have that diversity, whether it's conscious or subconscious to where things are, you know, the more touch points that you have and the more places you can create relationships, the better off you're going to.
Yep, exactly.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Joe, for sharing these personal sides of your career. And you've definitely hinted at the complexity of the cotton value chain and how we can all play our strengths to apply it in different corners of the industry. So if we're trying now to tackle the merchant side of the industry, jumping straight on, how, and especially targeting our audience here, who some of them know very well what a merchant is, but some of them don't. So in a few words, could you explain, in your view, what the role of a merchant is in the cotton industry?
Well, you asked for it in a few words. So my fewest words that I could say is essentially the producer and the grower grows or creates the product. The end user uses it. We do everything else in the middle. You know, traditionally, people think that that is that the merchants are traders, right? And they focus on price and that, yes, price is a large component of what we do, where we have to manage price risk that exists. But it's just one component of, you know, multitudes of other activities and risks that we do as a merchant. And it's the same role that we play especially Louis Dreyfus, whether it's in cotton or whether it's corn or soybeans or sugar or coffee or rice or all the way down the line of things that they do. So it's a multifaceted operation.
So could you name a few of those risks that you mentioned here?
Well, the risks, I mean, maybe I should start before the risk, talk a little bit about what it is that we do besides that. You know, when you look at it, especially in the cotton business, you have the producers, and then we have other segments along the line. But, you know, the merchants are involved in having to warehouse the commodity. We have to be a sales force. We have to be a marketing team. We have, you know, we have to be the credit department for the industry, the risk manager, finance provider. We have to control the quality. Execution, logistics, delivery of the product, you know, a customer service department. We have to handle many, many different risks besides price. You know, when you look at it, the grower is going to harvest, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, he's going to harvest October, November. A mill wants to buy in May and June. You know, who spans that time frame when the commodity's ready? The grower wants to sell when prices are high, and the consumer wants to buy when prices are low. So we have to do both. We have to sell when it's low, we have to buy when it's high, and then we have to hedge and use those hedges to protect ourselves to make those things work. And in cotton in particular, you know, if depending on the product that someone is making, they need a particular quality. And any one producer might make a range of different qualities, but the end user only wants one. And so we have to be the aggregator of supply. We have to be the separator of quality. And then we have to logistically handle it. And that's not always easy. I mean, just look back over, you know, your guys' careers and remember the problems that we had with COVID, for example. When we couldn't get things moved, or you couldn't get the containers, or the freight rates went up, you know, 10 times. And then look at where we are with the Red Sea, where we have to adjust, or the strikes that we've had at the ports. And these type of things are all parts of the risks that we have to handle as merchants, because at the end of the day, you know, we have to provide food and fiber to the people around the world where they want it, when they want it, how they want it. And, you know, that's covers pretty much every side of a business that you could possibly think of besides just price risk.
Yeah, certainly a ton of cotton is not just like a ton of grain, is it, Joe? There are a lot of complexities involved in it, and the supply chain is becoming much more integrated now as well. I think Cammy and I, we were talking about, we've just come off the back of the ICA trade event, and you know, there's a lot of discussion on production and consumption, and you know, demand issues. And I mean, one of the things we talked about was volatility in the market. Cammy, did you want to talk a little bit about what we discussed on where volatility is?
You did touch upon it, Joe, a little bit before. I think that a lot of people at the ICA conference highlighted the fact that, you know, we come out of very volatile years, and the cotton industry in general is used to these very volatile years. I mean, you can talk about 2011 much better than I can, of course, or the COVID years that you pointed. How do you perceive the role of the merchants being different in years of extreme volatility as opposed to a year like we are in today, where maybe the trading range of the cotton price is a little bit more stable? Do you see a difference in the role of the merchants in these two scenarios?
You know, I really don't see a difference in the role of the merchant between the two. I mean, obviously, higher volatility is going to be, by definition, a higher volatile market. But our role, essentially, being between the producer and the end user, stays the same. You know, the end user needs his cotton, needs his quality, needs it when he wants it. And whether prices are 50 cents or whether they're $1.50 or whether volatility is high or low, it's still our job to provide that product to the consumer when he needs it from where it is, and to provide liquidity to the grower and to provide them the marketplace in order to move their cotton. So I really don't think it's different. I mean, obviously, as you said, prices may move more quickly in one environment versus the other, but our role is the same.
Yeah, one of the things that I know that you've spoken about before is our ability to compete, and the biggest pressure that we're facing, and I think we've been talking about it for a very long time, but it's becoming very much the pointy end of the stick, so to speak, is our competition now with man-made fiber. You know, we talk about how do we compete, and One way to compete is price, but what does that do to the global cotton industry if we're competing with polyester on price, Joe?
Well, I don't think, at the end of the day, price is important, of course, but I don't think that's really how we combat or how we, you know, reestablish ourselves as the fiber of choice. It's not really price, because price assumes that no quality differential between that, that there are no other benefits to a certain product that exists. So I think we have to do a better job of telling our story. You know, for too long, cotton has stood by the wayside. And I think we've also made a mistake that we mostly tell our story to ourselves. And we all believe it. And so it's how do we get our story out to the general public, to the consumer, to understand the difference between something that's sustainable and biodegradable versus something that isn't, something that is polluting our waters with microfibers and getting in our, whether it's our fish, our beer, even from the plastic bottles. Some of it's not necessarily from pure polyester clothing, although polyester clothing is a major contributor to microfibers that exist, but it's not the only place that is where cotton is a natural fiber and is biodegradable. We need to tell that story, and we need to change the focus. You know, I believe some internal fighting from years ago in the cotton industry created this idea that cotton was either irresponsible in its production or because it used water to grow, as all agricultural plants do, that somehow we were not good stewards of the earth and of soil. But we've come a long way in the last 20 years with a massive reduction in water use, with sustainable agricultural processes that are out there. So we have a good story to tell. And I think one of the important things that we need to do is expand who's telling our story. Because it can't be us to ourselves. We need a different exposure to different audiences. And I think one of the most important things is we have to make sure we get in front of the EU and the new legislation that's out there so that they understand that if they want to support polyester, that they are going to pollute their waters. It's getting, and you can look up all the medical research. It's getting in our bodies. It's in our bloodstreams. It's in our organs. They're finding it in the reproductive organs of women and things along that line. Now, it's happening now very quickly. So we're not able to necessarily find conclusions because it's going to take a while to do that. Mm-hmm. This is not a scientific comment, but I wouldn't be surprised if we look back 20 years from now that we don't find some form of a relationship that's there that would be very beneficial to cotton in a relative sense, especially in a human health sense, versus microfibers in the world.
Yeah, I think one of the things you mentioned there is just this the increasing discussions we have amongst ourselves. We're an echo chamber. We're very good at what we do, but it's getting that message out to the non-cotton community. And I think that's starting, Joe. You know, we have an MOU between Brazil, Australia, and US to talk about the pre-competitive promotion of cotton, which is something we've never considered before, and getting the global industry together to have a more unified voice. We all know that the disinformation and the misinformation out there, but I guess it's up to all of us to find our best avenues to tell the story and to use the information that ultimately exists in our small way on the podcast. We're doing it with the farming series and with having Eva Billy on to talk about the EU legislation to try to demystify it so people actually understand the impact that it's going to have. One of the things that I think you've been always a proponent of is relationships in our industry. It seems to be different to other commodities in the fact that it's such a relationship-driven industry. Do you think that's going to benefit this challenge that we have to combat legislation and tell the positive story of cotton?
For sure. I mean, I think that the ability that, we tend our industry in general, not just merchandise, companies there, but along the line from grower to warehouseman to gins to cottonseed to all the way through down the whole value chain, all the way through textile mills as well. We have a common goal, you know, and we understand the ability for cotton to regain fiber share. People forget that, you know, wasn't that long ago, cotton may have had a 70% market share in cotton fiber, of fiber use. And fiber use continues to grow around the world, and cotton stays the same, which by definition means we're losing market share along those lines. So I think there is really a great opportunity for us to tell. But we have to realize today, when you look at the fashion world where it is, especially in the new generation, fast fashion is a phenomenon that's taking place, right? Wear something once, twice, whatever, dispose of it, it goes through. The majority of that is man-made fiber. It's not natural fibers because they're making it cheap, right? And the majority of it's coming from those countries that are the largest producers of polyester in the world. And so you would think that that young generation is maybe, they tend to be someone who presents themselves as very concerned about the environment, but yet their actions don't follow their thoughts. You know, they don't look at labels. They don't look at the process by which their products are being made. So that's a process that we have to be able to move forward on to try to capitalize to tell our story better, to get it out there.
And in that sense, the European legislation's intention is really good, is to simplify the labels, to make it more clear for users. But the unintended consequences of trying to simplify everything means that cotton is losing. So we are trying to fight that. If I could come back just for a minute on the, you know, the notion of merchants, you talked about warehousing. If anything, having been working with you and for you for the last decade, there are a few sentences that keep coming back in every single conversation that we have as a group of traders. And some of them, we all, you know, almost have them tattooed on our body. And one of them is, carry is real. Could you address this notion of carry in the industry, especially from the sense, and to combat the myth that the merchant, as you said, the trader who then would like to only buy when it's cheap, store, hoard, and only sell when it's high. Could you tackle a bit that myth?
Well, I don't know where you came up with that word hoard, but other than that, look, it's the same as any other industry. And if you go to any industry, I mean, look at the textile industry, look at the retailer brands within our own industry. One of the most important things they do is try to control their inventory levels, right? And because it's a real cost, you know, you're going to pay financing for what it is. You have to pay storage for holding that inventory. And your inventory ages. And cotton eventually does age too, although it's a slow process. It is a deteriorating asset over time that exists. Maybe not as fast as the banana example that I gave a couple of years ago in Australia as it turned black. But carry is real. And so, you know, that's one of the main things that a merchant has to do, is to evaluate what the marketplace is telling you, the value of a product is, of time against interest, against storage. And, you know, there are those in the industry that will try to use that to their advantage. You know, they'll try to buy a cheaper time zone and try to get you to ship it in a higher price zone from where things are. So we do pay close attention to the cost of carry, but I don't think we're very different than most other industries who have to do the same. You know, cotton being a little bit different than, say, other commodities, because, you know, there's a difference between a fungible and a non-fungible commodity, right? We're a non-fungible commodity. Stays in that bale form all the way to the textile mill. Maybe they can blend it a little bit, but it's not like corn or beans or wheat where you can take one bushel of high moisture, one bushel of high damage, mix them together and get two good bushels. You can't do that in cotton. And that's probably one of the reasons why the merchant's role is so complex. You would think it'd be more complex in something we eat than it is in something we wear. But that's not the case, right? And since we have to ship bale by bale of individual bales that have an individual number on them, you can imagine handling millions and millions of individual bales that you have to track, as opposed to just tonnage of a quality, say, and a fungible commodity. You can start to see the complexities of what our value chain is in the cotton world.
Right. And so you've had an incredible career. We touched on it at the beginning of this podcast. And I have seen firsthand how every single season, you are still so passionate about the industry. What is it this year, in this season that we're talking about, 24-25 marketing year, that you see as the most exciting story?
Really, the 23, 24, 24, 25 seasons are going to be defined by the acceleration and ascension of Brazil into the cotton world, right? At the exact same time that we went through three droughts in West Texas. So three knockout blows to the United States and continued expansion in Brazil has flip-flopped the cotton world from a cotton standpoint. I think that that's probably, you know, if we'll look back over history, this will be the time frame where people will see the changing of the guard that took place. Not that the U.S. Won't again at some point in time maybe have a big crop and be the largest exporter again. You know, obviously we need weather in order to do that. But our area is not expanding in the United States. Well, it's still expanding in Brazil. The longer term, that trend's gonna is gonna continue to move forward. You know, we have a lot of 24, 25 to go, right? I mean, we're talking here, I guess it's the 28th of October, right? We've got about a week to the United States election for the next president. It'll be really interesting. Not necessarily even who wins, but the implications really of how that plays out is probably going to be more important. And I don't think that's a very clear. I know some people think that they see that very clearly according to who wins, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah, certainly that Chinese proverb, may we live in interesting times. We're definitely in interesting times. It's very difficult to forecast what's going to happen after 6th of November. It's certainly going to impact everybody. That, I guess, and the amount of legislation facing everybody along the supply chain and trying to control these natural assets that we have. Joe, something came up at the ICA trade event, and we kind of touch on it every now and then around trading, and that's AI. And I know when I first met you, you were actually lecturing at the cotton school that I was attending many moons ago, and you talked about data a lot. You talked about focusing on getting as much data as you could on crops, what was happening with crop growth, what was happening in weather in different countries in the world. And I think you've been a leader at the forefront of gathering data. How does AI impact positively or negatively, or how do you see it as a game changer in data collection and coordination?
Well, I think, you know, data collection and coordination today, one of the challenges is that there's so much data out there. You can somewhat just get submerged in it and not necessarily what it means. And so there are, in our business in particular, we don't really have the ability to gain more data than some of these large AI groups that are out there that are just phenomenal in what it is that they do. But we have different data than they have, right? Because we're in the business. So we have direct relationship data that we have. We have transactional data that we have. And sometimes it's the ability to sort through the mountain of data to find which parts are so particular. And when it comes to the marketplace, you know, the marketplace will focus on many different things. At times, it may focus on carryouts. At times, it may focus on economic activity. Sometimes, it can be on political activity. Sometimes, it can be fear that it focuses on. And so, even though the data may be compatible with other years, if the focus is different at that particular time, you know, if you were looking at just carryouts or things, for example, during COVID, you'd get a very different situation. If you didn't look at the situation in the Black Sea or later in the Red Sea, you wouldn't be able to just look at what would be traditional data and come up with the right conclusions that's there. So I think AI is important, and I think data collection is important, but I think data utilization is the most important part of it, knowing what to look at when. AI has accelerated the process so fast, but through my career, I've seen so many different changes that have taken place where all of a sudden, whether it's a new idea when we transferred from the traditional trading companies, then we went to CTAs, and then we had hedge funds, then you had index funds. And every time that they've gone through and have gained some type of advantage, I always call it the anti something comes up on the other side of it, right? It grows so big that people now start to plan against it because they start to see their footsteps in the sand, so to speak. And AI is going to be the same thing as far as trading and marketplaces go, because as someone builds a better mousetrap to where it is, eventually their success, if it doesn't continue to evolve, something else will evolve against it. And so I think the challenge, you know, for us in our industry isn't necessarily just in AI. It's how do we continue to evolve to try to stay near the front or the cutting edge of where those trends and focus changes come, as it's going to continue to evolve as time goes by.
A lot of wisdom in these comments. Thank you, Joe. Being conscious of time, unfortunately, we have to draw to a close. But before we do so, we really like to ask all of our guests, what's the one thing about cotton you would like our audience to know?
You know, I will leave you with two answers to that. I'm going to leave you to what's the one thing about a cotton career that I'd like you to know, right? Because it's more about cotton and then about cotton. So I'm going to start with the cotton piece first. And that is that it is a life. You know, it's not a fiber. It is a life. People don't realize that we feed a lot of the world. People think of the cotton plant as a fiber plant, and it is, but it is also one of the highest sources of protein produced in the world, right? Whether it's crushed or the majority of it being fed, mostly to dairy cows and to cows and to cattle and stuff that is used for dairy, for food, people forget that it is a high protein source that's there. But along that line, when I said the cotton is, it's communities, it's people. You see people in this business who've been in it for generations, for it is. And it's just something about this particular product that people see that they love, right? That provides livelihoods, not just for the grower, but for so many people in the world as it continually evolves from whether it's going to make a super fine, wonderful fabric or bed sheet or a towel or jeans or even mops or medical wear. And it touches so many different groups and it is a life in and of itself. And I think that's that would be my cotton comment.
I love that answer.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. But my other answer about our industry, you know, and you know, I've done it for a long time, right? But if you look through our industry, a lot of people have been in our industry a long time, too. There's a sense, the other word that I love using about working or whatever is passion. You know, people have passion for this industry, and people are passionate about what they do. And if you're passionate about it, I mean, you'll spend more time in it, right? You'll enjoy it. You will be better at it. And I think cotton's got a lot of passionate people in it.
It does. It does. I agree. Thank you so much, Joe, for sharing your story and your thoughts today.
It was a pleasure to be with you, as always. And I think as you opened up the show with, I'll end it with, is I support women in cotton.
Great.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time and your support. Oh, that was a great chat with Joe. To be honest, I thought we'd actually gone well over 45 minutes on that, because I guess we're so used to having those in-depth discussions with Joe, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. And as we were wrapping up and saying goodbye to Joe, I quickly prompted something in a chatbot, because we were talking about AI, and I asked AI, what is the role of a cotton merchant, to see if we could have done that episode in only 2 minutes on a chatbot, asking to summarize in just a few words. And ChatGPT, not to name it, sorry, said, cotton merchants source, trade, and manage logistics of cotton, ensuring quality and compliance while analyzing market trends and maintaining relationships in the cotton supply chain. I think there's the gist of it, but there's not really the passion that Joe conveyed here, right?
Oh, look, I think that's exactly the message, Cammy, isn't it? I mean, this is a relationship-driven industry. It's a passionate industry. People stay in for a very long time. And through the challenges and the ups and downs, I'm sure Joe would have gone to another industry if it wasn't as, you know, challenging and equally as rewarding for over 40 years of his career. And there have been so many changes during that time frame. I'm sure we can get him back on again at some point to talk about that, you know, the massive amount of changes from when he joined to what we're facing now.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, he leads to the point of the U.S. election. So we're going to try and question this. There is going to be the U.S. sourcing summit coming up in a couple of weeks, and that will be right post U.S. election. So hopefully we'll learn a lot about the consequences of whoever the next U.S. president is, and we can cover some of that in our future podcast episode.
I don't think any trader likes sitting in the doldrums. It's like sailing with no wind. There's really very little direction. So hopefully we'll get to find some direction really soon. Yeah. So I look again, the passion for the industry has come out. And I think it's always invigorating to hear somebody who spent that much of their life in cotton and still want to continue down that path. So I was very happy to hear everything that Joe had to say. And what's the saying about if you love your job, you never work a day in your life?
I heard the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Himar. Thanks everyone for listening to this week's episode of The Thing About Cotton. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Catch us next time when we try to shed some light on the US election as well as dive deeper into more of the farming practices around the world. If you want to learn more about today's episodes or have other questions about the cotton value chain, feel free to email us at podcast@ica-ltd.org. Don't forget to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google, and follow the Women in Cotton group on LinkedIn and Facebook to find out about our upcoming podcast episodes, events, and engage with men and women in the industry. Special thanks to the International Cotton Association for giving us this platform to deliver the podcast.